Live from welcome to New York. This is
the Just End the Suffering podcast.
For the win.
Got it!
Oh! He broke his ankle!
Follow me! Follow me to freedom!
Y'all ready for this?
Here's your host, Mike Phillips.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to today's episode of the Just End the Suffering podcast, New York sports long-suffering fan. Your host, Mike Phillips. I got a good show for you this week. It's actually a two-show week because we could do our baseball preview show on Thursday, actual opening day, not Korean opening day. But we're getting into the March Madness today. We're going to be joined again by Troy Moriel. Continue on March Madness coverage. Recap the first weekend. Set the Sweet 16, the Elite Eight, get you ready for the Final Four. All that good stuff with Troy in just a bit. We're also going to do our two-minute drill here. Tell the impact J.D. Martinez is going to bring to the Mets. He was a sneak attack signing during the opening rounds of the NCAA tournament, so I'll break that down at the end of the podcast. You want to get stuff like a Just End the Suffering podcast? Feel free to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, TuneIn, Spotify, Amazon, all the usual suspects. Simply search for Just End the Suffering Affair podcast platforms. You can find all episodes there. Feel free to your feedback and star ratings as well. They help make the podcast even better going forward. Check out the YouTube page, Mike Phillips on YouTube. Video version of the conversation with Troy is up on the YouTube channel. Again, Mike Phillips on YouTube. Without any further ado, let's get to our opening tip here. We're going to talk about the wild Shohei Ohtani betting interpreting scandal here. That's going to come up here right after this.
3, 2, 1.
Y'all ready for this?
The opening tip.
And here we go. Go.
All right, opening tip time here, and most of our focus last week in the sporting world was on the NCAA tournament. In New York here, some key moves with the Mets and the Jets. We had a scandal emerge in the NBA opening series between the Dodgers and Padres in South Korea. ESPN report came out last week that the Dodgers fired Ippe Mizuhara, the interpreter for Shohei Ohtani. Mizuhara got himself into trouble with $4.5 million in gambling debts that were paid for by wire transfers from Ohtani's bank account, which that would be a crime for Ohtani if he was paying an illegal bookie. The story got even more bizarre when Ohtani, whose camp originally made the interpreter available for the interview with ESPN, backtracked and claimed that he was the victim of quote-unquote massive theft and that Mizuhara had stolen the money from Ohtani to pay the bookie. Mizuhara then switched his story to match Ohtani's, which led to more strange reports about this guy, including some from The Athletic. They basically said that he's lied on his resume about where he went to school. Apparently, the school he went to said he never went there. He claimed he worked for the Red Sox and the Yankees. Neither of them said he ever worked for them. It sounds like that all of a sudden we have Mizuhara is now the George Santos of baseball. MLB seems to want no part of investigating this, evidenced by the fact that they announced their investigation with a late Friday news dump on the first Friday of the NCAA tournament. When gambling is involved, you have to see this through. The one thing that feels clear to me, you're looking through all the reports and whatnot, is that Ohtani was not the one placing the bets. It was the interpreter. I do believe the initial story that Mizuhara went to Ohtani for help when he was in debts, and Ohtani wanted to be a good friend and paid off the debts. Because as Fox's Craig Carton points out, and Carton, more than anybody would know about the issues of bookies and gambling and so on and so forth, these payments came from Ohtani's personal accounts. It is very hard to wire that money without Ohtani's knowledge or his signature. Plus, as Carton points out, the bookie likely let a guy in interpreter's salary rack up that much debt because he figured Ohtani was bankrolling the guy. Which, obviously, if you're a bookie, you don't take, and you're taking bets on credit, you're not taking bets from money who can't pay it to you. If you're letting a guy on an interpreter's salary, let's be generous, say he's making like $100,000 a year, you're letting him get $4.5 million in gambling debt, you're not doing that because he can't pay you. You're doing it, you figure that, okay, Shohei Ohtani is worth millions and millions of dollars, and he's paying for it, so I'll be okay there. I'll get my money. Ohtani's team changed the story because they realized this is about Ohtani legal jeopardy, since paying off those illegal debts I mentioned earlier was a crime. Also about Ohtani potential trouble with the league, which has the rule against gambling as evidenced by Pete Rose getting banned for life for betting on the Reds. The interpreter said he never bet on baseball. Instead, insisting he bets on international soccer games, basketball, and football. Given how close he is to Ohtani, he came from the Angels with him, and the nature of legalized gambling these days. MLB cannot just bury its hand in the sand and hope that this blows over. There's a full investigation into how Ohtani, whose life is so controlled and calculated that the media does not even know what his life looks like, how this guy could possibly have $4.5 million stolen from his personal bank accounts. And again, this is the key here. This came from the bank accounts. This is not, as Craig Carton said, this is not like Ohtani had cash lying on the table that Mizuhara just threw in a bag and paid the bookie that way. These were consistent $500,000 wire transfers from Ohtani's bank accounts, which it's very hard to believe that somebody who's so in control of a situation as Ohtani or his agent, Nas Bolello, is, that Mizuhara could do this over and over again without raising any red flags. A guy that close to the game's best player with that big gambling issue is a problem. You have to make sure that your global superstar here, MLB, is not in a position to be either bet on baseball, giving information you could use to influence betting lines, dealing with the interpreter who is financially compromised. Again, Ohtani didn't place the bet, so I don't think he did. I don't think we're looking at a serious suspension. I expect he gets fined, maybe like a short suspension. But given how much money changed hands and the wild story change we've seen with the accounts of this, it'd be irresponsible not to look at this thoroughly. Hopefully, in baseball's sake, that Ohtani's not actually betting or passing information along that could have lead to bets. But you can't ignore this. It's too big. We'll keep an eye on this, see what happens here. But up next, we'll recap the first weekend of March Madness with Troy Moriello right after this. All right, we are back here on the podcast getting ready for some March Madness coverage here. We are down from 68 teams to 16. We are getting one step closer to crowning our national champion. As always, you've seen him on the Carton Show, on the researchers there. Great college basketball contributor, Troy Moriello, is here with us. Troy, how are you?
I'm all right, Mike. Just spent, the last 4 days watching college hoops, so couldn't be better, and I'm waiting for Thursday to come around.
Well, six. You got the first four games.
Yeah, true. Even Tuesday and Wednesday, you're right.
Yeah, so a lot of basketball here. I got to go to Brooklyn here. I'm rocking the March Madness shirt here.
Has all the
logos of the teams on here. Two of these teams are still dancing. The other six got sent home. But general thoughts on what we saw so far from the tournament.
I mean, there wasn't really any major upsets outside of the Oakland over Kentucky. Obviously, you had NC State kind of make that, I guess you could say, Cinderella run, although they've been playing like a top 25 team over the past 2 weeks. You know, they're really the only high, double-digit seed that's made this type of run. We've seen every one and every two seed make it through. Personally, I don't, mind it, because now we get some awesome games in the Sweet 16. I mean, you look at these matchups in the Sweet 16 and these potential matchups in the Elite Eight, you truly are going to see the top, 10 to 15 teams in the country. I mean, obviously, would it be nice to maybe have one or two other of these, double-digit Cinderella-type teams, yes. But at the end of the day, I think that we saw this weekend, maybe, this season of college basketball was a little more top-heavy than we realized, and there truly were these, 10 national title contenders, and everyone else was kind of, further apart from them than we thought. And that's kind of, I think, what's led to what we've seen now. But again, I'm okay with that. I like seeing these awesome matchups now. Sure, it was not totally exciting. It wasn't the most, fun. There was only a handful of games that came down to the final possession. We talked about that off air, but at the end of the day, it leads to some awesome Sweet 16 and Elite Eight and hopefully Final Four matchups. So it's a trade-off there,
Yeah, for me, I feel like the first round was fine. I think we peaked about 6:50 on Friday night when you had the down the wire finishes of the Florida Colorado game and the Auburn Yale game, basically ending in second of each other with the upsets. And after that, it's sort of really the quality of play sort of went downhill fast because, obviously I was in the building at Barclays Friday night. We had a lot of fun with JMU. They didn't show up against Duke on Sunday. They didn't play well. The underdog basically got wiped off the floor here. And, it's crazy because, apart from, the two late-night games, the Oregon game and the Houston-Texas A&M game on Sunday night, the second round was just not competitive.
Second round was rough. I got a stat for you right here, Mike. Over the first two rounds, so this is the first three rounds, the first four, the first round, and the second round, games were decided by 15.4 points. That's the highest since 1993. So over 30 years that we've gone since games were this, large blowouts, basically, through the first couple rounds. Obviously, that's a little bit inflated with the Purdue blowout of of Utah State, the Duke blowout of JMU, of course, but there just weren't that many great games, especially, like you said, in the second round. I mean, you had the two late night games. Marquette, Colorado was an awesome game yesterday as well. I don't want to sell that one short, but outside of that, a lot of blowouts. And I think what hurt the viewing experience a little bit too were the blowouts in the standalone windows.
Yes.
Like you had early yesterday. Well, early yesterday was a great game, obviously, but then you had at 2:50 or the 2:40 window, whatever it was, Purdue blowing out Utah State, then Duke blowing out JMU. I mean, you really went from like 2 o'clock to 7 o'clock yesterday without watching any competitive basketball. And it even happened a little bit on Saturday as well with Gonzaga. That game obviously was close at least for a half, but then blowing out Kansas again, when you have these blowouts in the standalone windows, it really, really hurts because then, you know, you're sitting through a halftime, you're sitting through a whole second half that's a blowout. You've got a whole, sometimes a whole break until the next game, and then you've got to get to the next one. So you're sitting there for like two and a half hours, not watching competitive basketball. I think that really hurt as well. I understand why they do it with the TV contracts and everything, but those standalone games going into starting the second weekend, especially on Sunday, it really kind of kills the viewing experience, in my opinion.
Yeah, if you were somebody who like needs to touch some grass here, those standalone ones are actually perfect for you because like you had like 3 hours to go outside, like you could read a book, you could like, you know, do some laundry, you could like take a break from the basketball and not miss a thing.
Well, Saturday here on the East Coast, it was raining all day. There's nothing to do outside. I'm sitting there, you know, and I got the Gonzaga Kansas game. I was like, okay, at least we got a good game here. And then it turns into a blowout. I got nowhere to go. I got nothing else to watch. I just got to sit there and watch this game. Again, I understand why they do it, but especially on Sunday, I wish they would not stack all these like five games at 7 o'clock or later. You know, people got to work the next day. People can't be staying up to watch, you know, Houston, Texas A&M at, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning. I wish that they would maybe, you know, move some of those games into like the late afternoon window because people are home on Sundays watching these games. So that's my one big complaint about the scheduling.
They got the poor Yale fans who had to wait till like 10:15 on Sunday to see their second round game tip off.
Yeah. And then you're getting blown out too. You're staying up till 11:30 midnight on a Sunday night, you know, seeing your team get crushed. It just, you know, it's a tough situation, of course.
Yeah, let's talk real quick before we get into the specifics here. Some of the non-tournament headlines that have been happening around college basketball here. And number one here, can we talk about how ridiculous it is that the transfer portal opened like the day after Selection Sunday here? Like this is like leading to like insane outcomes here where we have like teams skipping the NIT to go, go portal hunting. We have all of this attention on guys entering the portal, leaving the portal. I mean, poor Iona had every single scholarship player on the roster enter the portal. Can we wait 2 weeks? Can we wait till the Final Four set before we do this?
Yeah, it's the most obvious solution. And I hope that they make that change, you know, going forward. It's like I saw someone say, it's like the NBA, you know, starting free agency midway through the playoffs or the NFL doing the same thing. Like, it would never make sense for those of these. Why are we doing that now? This is basically free agency when you think about it in college sports. So we're starting free agency while 64, 32, 16 teams are still playing. And it just doesn't really make any sense whatsoever. Like you said, it's causing teams to skip out on other postseason opportunities because they got to get to the work on the portal. I'm a St. John's fan, as you know. You know, they skip out on the NIT. Obviously, the NIT wasn't going to do much for them. Would I like to see them play more games as a fan? Absolutely. But I understand the decision to not play in the NIT just because, you know, you got to get to work on the portal. You know, it's time to now rebuild your roster for next year and playing, you know, two or three extra games and extending the season by two or three extra weeks, you know, might take away from the chances that you get to figure out who's going to be on your roster for next year, what guys are leaving, what guys can you bring in. So it's taking away postseason opportunities from these teams because they just can't do it. And it's making teams, you know, in the field of 68 have to recruit while they're playing games. It's a mess. I think it was Alabama landed a transfer while before their first round game. It's like, what are we doing? You got a kid on NC State transferring before the tournament started. It's absolute lunacy.
Yeah, to me, it's like the same stupidity, too, as like the NFL system where you have like the coordinators interviewing for head coaching jobs while their team's still in the playoffs here. It makes no sense. I mean, like, we really need like something to have to staff worry about getting the guy out of the portal when they're trying to get ready for a first-round game.
Exactly, yeah. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Push it back, like you said, push it back to the Final Four weekend. That's totally fine. At that point, you know, majority of the teams are now into their offseason. That's fine. You know, the four teams that are in the Final Four will live, you know, being a week behind on everyone else. I think they'll take that trade off playing in a Final Four. Yeah, push it back like 2 weeks and then everything is solved. It's really not that hard to do. So hopefully that's a change that's made in the next couple of years.
Yeah, and led to the NIT sort of chaos here where like we, before the year, I know I complained like about this big time about how we sort of stacked the deck for, oh, we have to get power conferences in here so we can carry this whatever tournament that Fox Sports was playing to be bringing all these Big East and Big Ten teams afterwards. And then everybody doesn't want to go. I mean, the Pac-12, like they gave, basically gave each of the power sex conferences two automatic bids. Pac-12 couldn't even fill it because 17 said no.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, the allure of the NIT has obviously taken a nosedive in the past, I would say, even 5 years, you know, not even going to the Garden now. You go to Hinkle Fieldhouse in Indiana if you make the Final Four. I just don't know if that's much of a draw. And like I said before, you know, these teams, I think these coaches would rather get a jump on recruiting than playing what they think are kind of meaningless games. And especially if you're a team that kind of just missed out on the field, you know, my team being a perfect example of that, I'm not really sure what you're going to get out of the NIT. You know, if you make a run in the NIT, does it make you feel better that you know, you ended the season in the NIT semifinals or the NIT finals? I'm not really sure. So the allure of the NIT just is not there. Again, you're not finishing it at the Garden. So I understand why some of these teams turn it down. Other ones, it's like, you know, would a few more games really kill you? But again, the mentality of these coaches is, you know, why am I coaching these games that aren't going to matter? I got to figure out my roster for next year so that I can get back in a position where I can be playing in the field of 68 and not turning down an NIT invite.
Yeah, plus I know in the past there's this argument, oh, you know, like if you have a young team, the NIT is valuable because you can, you know, continue to grow as a scorer. It doesn't matter because, like, if you finish the NIT, three guys on that team, you just go in the portal, look for somewhere better.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Again, 5 years ago, sure, if you had a team of mostly, you know, underclassmen, you're trying to build something, you're trying to get postseason tournament experience, sure, play in the NIT, play a couple of games, see how your team responds, and then build something for next year. Again, you could do that this year. You got two or three freshmen. They're gone. You're bringing in new guys. You know, your whole roster turns over. It doesn't matter. That's the last time that these guys are going to play together. So, yeah, that's a great point as well.
Plus, I mean, even for teams that did make they take the NIT invitation. We saw, like, Providence. I think, like, Carter didn't even play because, like, he was sitting out evaluating his options.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, you're not even getting the best of these teams. Providence was the perfect example, losing to Boston College. You could tell that they weren't really there. Even Seton Hall, who's now advanced a couple of rounds in the NIT, the first like 35 minutes of their game against St. Joe's, they looked like they didn't want to be there. It's tough. You know, I'm sure it's tough for these kids to get up and playing a game that they think doesn't really matter after having the heartbreak of missing out, being one of the first, you know, 10 teams missing out on the NCAA tournament. I'm sure it's tough for them to get up as well. So I completely understand why teams are turning it down. I wish, again, maybe pushing the portal back a little bit helps solve a little bit of that, at least.
Yeah, and we'll quickly hit the coaching carousel. We have two big ones so far here. Dusty May spurns Louisville and goes to Michigan. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I was shocked because it seemed like he was a lock to go to Louisville. You know, I'm curious to see where they turn now in their search. But I like the fit of Michigan. I mean, you look at this guy, was able to turn around FIU, really did an amazing job over these past two years. You know, taking them all the way to the Final Four last year, a program that, you know, with the resources that they have, the job that he did there is incredible. Now he goes to Michigan, obviously, with unlimited resources. But I think that the interesting thing is, you know, how is he going to be able to, or maybe he's a better fit for a team that football is first. You know, football is always going to be first at Michigan. Can he, you know, will he be able to adapt to a school that basketball is kind of on the back burner? Obviously, the resources are there, but that's a football school. You know, maybe Juwan Howard struggled with that a little bit. I'm curious to see how Dusty May does, but I like the hire. You know, you can't complain about hiring a guy who completely, you know, revolutionized what his previous school was doing. So I can't have anything bad to say about it right now.
Yeah, that's one hire. One that broke like right before we recorded here, that we had Mark Byington from James Madison took the Vanderbilt job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, I mean, and, you know, kind of a similar, almost identical situation to Michigan, right? You had a former player leaving Vandy, hiring this kind of up-and-coming coach who led a mid-major on a season that they'll never forget at JMU. Again, you can't say anything bad about it right now. I mean, you know, if you're a Vanderbilt fan, you've got a real college basketball coach in there, so I would say the future is bright for him as well.
Yeah, and the other one that was notable here is that great hire at West Virginia, getting Darian DeVries from Drake. He's done a great job there. He's bringing his son Tucker with him to Morgantown here. So you figure that the Mountaineers will be right back in the mix next year for a potential at-large bid with that.
Yeah, it was such a weird offseason for them, obviously, with the Huggins departure. I mean, that's a program that doesn't stay down for too long. So, yeah, absolutely. I could see them turning it around very, very quickly. with that hire. And you know, that's a program that usually makes the right, well, not makes the right hire, but usually makes the right decisions. And I would say it's going to be a quick turnaround, an easy turnaround for them as well.
Yeah, so yeah, that's some stuff we'll keep an eye on here. There's more big names on the board, but we'll go back to the tournament here, the actual games here. So we'll get some headlines here. So go chronologically here. Virginia in the first four, playing complete egg, where with Charles McClellan and Coors having to watch it was great.
Yeah, I mean, with Virginia, it's, you know, a lot of people did not think that, me included, did not think they were an NCAA tournament team. And, you know, they proved everyone right. I mean, that was a performance that is, you know, a real egg on the face of the committee, you know, letting that team in. That team, you know, no one really had them anywhere near the bubble, to be honest with you, you know, entering Selection Sunday. And they go out and they lay an absolute egg offensively. They get blown out by Colorado State. And again, you know, that's a Virginia team. Great program, great coach. This year, they should not have been in the NCAA tournament. You could have named five or six teams probably that were more deserving of going to that game than Virginia was. I mean, you know, and thinking of the fan bases, like I'm a big St. John's fan, as you know. I had to turn that game off because I was getting too frustrated watching this Virginia team try to score and saying, man, they picked Virginia over St. John's. And I'm one of, again, five or six. Think about how Indiana State felt. Think about how Seton Hall felt, Oklahoma, Pitt. Like, these teams got to be furious watching that Virginia performance, saying, man, they put these guys in over us. At the very least, those teams would have played a more competitive and entertaining game, you know, where you're not watching a team go scoreless for almost an hour of real time. Like, those teams would have at least played an entertaining game, or a more entertaining game than Virginia would have.
Yeah, and as somebody who's worked in production, you could tell the production crew was not happy having to watch that game, because, like, the fact they actually put on this, I got a little graphic here, Virginia's first point scored says 9:48 p.m. Eastern time. It's like, yeah, they're not happy with having to watch that.
Exactly, and that's why, like, you know, sometimes, like, let's just use our heads. Let's just use the eye test. Like, the eye test sometimes can work in your favor. And I'm not just saying that because of St. John's, but, you know, Virginia is not an entertaining team to watch. No one outside of Virginia fans and alums want to watch Virginia in an NCAA tournament game this year. It's not going to be an entertaining product. Put your most entertaining product out there. I would have loved to see Seton Hall play Colorado State or Indiana State and that team into the NCAA tournament. That would have been awesome. Of course, my team getting into the NCAA tournament would have been great. Sometimes just think about the entertainment value. Just think about what team is going to play the most entertaining game, you know, and use the eye test, and then it'll work out for you. So,
yeah, that's for sure. Let's get into, obviously, the upset of the week. We had some big ones. We had some interesting ones at the lower seeds on Thursday. We had Duquesne upset BYU. We had some the Yale crazies on Friday we'll get to here. But Oakland over Kentucky is the end of the first round here with Jack Gehlke, who plays D2 for 5 years, transfers to D1 as a grad student. Hits 10 threes, gives the MJ shrug to the CBS cameras. It's great stuff here. And this was wild watching this play out, seeing, like, Kentucky again flame out in a big spot in the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, and for Kentucky, I mean, you know, the question marks now start, obviously, with Cal's future there. And the question mark for me is, you know, do you want to send guys to the NBA, or do you want to be, you know, a program that wins titles? Because at this point now, you know, you've been a program for years that has obviously, you know, been very, very good at sending talent to the NBA, at finding talent, at coaching talent. But at the end of the day, you're not winning NCAA tournament games. You know, you're losing to double-digit seeds year after year. And the interesting thing to note about that game is, you know, who are Kentucky's best two players in that game? Antonio Reeves and Trey Mitchell, two of their upperclassmen. Their freshmen did not deliver. And I think at the end of the day, you're seeing year after year, freshmen don't deliver. You know, it's so hard to win six games in a tournament setting with a team that's built on you know, mostly underclassmen and freshmen, you know, and it's shown year after year. So does Kentucky want to keep sending, you know, these one and done kids to the NBA, or do they want to win championships? That's kind of the answer that they need to figure out.
Yeah, I know Cal said something about this. He's like, you know, it's like, my job to make sure these guys are ready for the next level here. It's like, yeah, but couldn't you do that with a 20-year-old? They help the 20-year-old get ready for a pro career somewhere?
Yeah, like, isn't that every coach's job, but also to win games in March? Like, that's also your job. It's kind of a, you know, a two-pronged approach. Like, you're not just making sure these guys are ready for the next level. You're also trying to win on this level. And the past 5 to 10 years, that just hasn't happened.
Yeah, and we talked about the coaching carousel before. If they decide to part with Cal, and again, we don't know what his contract situation is, whether there's offset language in there, They dip in the endowment to get rid of him. Like, mm-hmm. if that opens up Kentucky, like, everything changes for the whole landscape of the sport, because, like, that's one of the five jobs. Like, if it opens, like, everybody wants to go for it.
Exactly. Yeah, that is going to absolutely, you know, be a game changer. Who knows where they would go. You brought up to me about Patino. That is probably the one school that I'm like, would he consider going back there from St. John's to Kentucky? Like the possibilities of the Kentucky job would be endless. Obviously, who knows what would happen with Louisville then. That'd be so interesting seeing both of those open at the same time. So, you know, at this point now, I guess it's a little bit less likely. It's been a couple of days. I know that he's speaking tonight. So I guess we'll see what happens there. But yeah, if that job opens up, the carousel could go absolutely crazy here. In terms of having that job open and then seeing, because you know then another high major job is going to open as well. So very, very interesting to see what happens there.
And remember, I know this is something St. John fans don't want to hear. Rick Pitino has always said his biggest regret in his career is leaving Kentucky to go back to the NBA. So
exactly. That's the only job where I'm like, let's hope for our sake that Cal just stays there and we don't even have to worry about it.
Yeah, for sure. Here, let's go to, I think, the other big headline here. These fantastic finishes. We've got some of these games here. The two on Friday with Yale, with the Yale-Auburn game, the Colorado-Florida game with the big shot making from K.J. Simpson and former Iona transfer Walter Clayton down with the Gators. Mm-hmm. You had those going back-to-back here. You had the crazy end to the Houston A&M game. The Oregon-Creighton game was nuts here. Those four finishes, they were definitely one of the highlights of the week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that Oregon-Creighton game was just unbelievable. What was it? Jermaine Cuisinart on Oregon just played crazy out of his mind. And you talk about that Creighton team, man. They got some scores as well. What an entertaining game that was. I thought the best game of the weekend was probably the Colorado Florida game. You know, you talk about Colorado doing everything they could to give that game away and then ending up hitting the shot at the end. Walter Clayton, Iona kid, just went absolutely crazy as well in that one. So, like you said, the tournament probably peaked at that point with the Yale over Auburn, and then you had the crazy Colorado game. And then obviously you didn't get a whole lot, but on Saturday night, that Oregon-Creighton game was phenomenal. And Colorado playing two very, very entertaining games as well against Marquette. You know, that game, Colorado, man, they just could not break through against Marquette. They kept, you know, falling behind by about five or six, then coming back and tying it and just couldn't get that push to take the lead and maybe extend the lead a little bit. Had a couple of open good looks at the end of that game as well. Like, did not go down from their best players. So tough end for Colorado, but they played by far the two of the most entertaining games in the tournament.
For sure. Let's go around the conferences here. Some stuff that's happened here that, like, who did well, who didn't. We have to start with our friend Greg Sankey in the SEC, because they were sent 18s to the field, which is a tie with the Big 12 for the most. Only two of them are still alive here. We saw five go out the first week, the first round here. We saw mm-hmm. another go out last night, the Texas A&M game here. So SEC flameout feels very well deserved, considering how hard Sankey's trying to, like, tear his tournament apart for more money.
Yeah, exactly. It's just perfect karma. You had a couple of SEC teams obviously go down, and now, you know, you lose almost all of your teams going into the second weekend. It's perfect karma. I love it. You know, the Big 12 as well, really not that impressive of a showing out of them. They lose a good number of their teams as well. You know, so maybe these conferences were, it's hard to make, you know, complete, you know, these massive statements about these conferences, based on a single elimination, tournament. But at the end of the day, you know, when you're the Big 12 and you were looked at as, you know, this number one conference, and the SEC as well looked at as one of the, you know, top two or three conferences in the country, you know, a lot of those teams let you down. And especially the SEC's case, you know, when you had Auburn, who a lot of people had as, you know, maybe a sleeper Final Four pick going down. Kentucky, a lot of people had them as a, you know, as a Final Four, you know, maybe even national champion team. They go down as well. It's just a bad look on your conference when the top teams in your conference don't deliver. You know, losing those teams that are, you know, in the 8-9 type game or the 7-10 type game is one thing. But losing the top teams in your conference, that really, really hurts, because obviously those are teams that are losing to, you know, seeds that they should not be losing to.
Yeah, it defends the Big 12. Yeah, the Big 12 does have their top two teams still in it, in Iowa mm-hmm. State and Houston. But mm-hmm. it makes you wonder here, with these conferences that are getting so many teams in here, you're killing yourself too much in league play, where you have nothing left by the time you get to the tournament.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And you know, in some cases, are we giving some of these teams a little too much credit just for playing in these conferences? You know, that's the question that's going to be asked as well, fair or not. I feel like that's going to be a question that's asked, and I've seen it thrown around. Oh, the Big 12 got too many bids. SEC got too many bids. you know, are when you see a performance like that at these conferences, the questions are asked. You know, are we giving teams too much credit just for playing in these tough leagues and giving them bids that maybe should be going to, you know, mid-major schools or teams like that?
Yeah, I want to separate the Mountain West here because they're a separate animal here. Because I feel like a big talking point on Twitter over the weekend is, oh, the Mountain West is overrated again. They got just one team through. Like, San Diego State won in the Sweet 16. Then we saw Colorado State do nothing when they got out of the first four. Boise State couldn't get out of the first four. I think only two teams. I think they had the big collapse in Nevada here.
Yeah.
I think the big issue I have with them is not so much that they got so many teams in here, but I think a lot of these teams were better than their seedings. They got put in worse matches than they should have been by the committee.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they got underseeded across the board when you look at the Mountain West. You know, basically you could argue every team outside of maybe San Diego State was a little bit underseeded. The problem with the Mountain West, and this is another one where, you know, fair or not, you know, when you send six teams and you only get one through to the second weekend and the other five, you know, kind of embarrass themselves or at least, you know, varying levels of embarrassing themselves, you know, fair or not, that's going to lead to the social media discourse of, you know, this league did not deserve it. This league should never get six bids again. This is a one bid or two bid league going forward, just fair or not. I mean, and again, you talk about the flameouts, you know, Colorado State, obviously having that brutal first half performance against Texas. You had Nevada blowing that big lead. You had Utah State getting absolutely crushed by Purdue. I know Purdue's one of the best teams in the country, but, you know, still on national TV in a standalone game, getting killed in that scenario. Boise State not making it out of the first round. So, you know, you had these teams that not only did they lose, but they lost in these kind of headline grabbing ways that, you know, if you're trying to push that agenda of the Mountain West did not deserve these six bids and the Mountain West, you know, is a one bid or two bid league or three bid max league. You know, if you're trying to push that agenda, you now have this tangible evidence to kind of grasp onto, fair or not, because again, they were underseeded. Absolutely. But that discourse is now going to be out there just because of the way that this conference formed. And especially sending San Diego State, who's kind of been, you know, the premier team of that conference for the last, you know, decade or two decades, you know, them being the only one that gets through and then not being one of these teams that kind of isn't there, or, you know, or one of these surprise teams like a Nevada or a Boise State that was able to push through, that hurts them. And again, the discourse is not going to be pretty for the Mountain West. Fair or not, it's not going to be pretty.
You even mentioned New Mexico here, who basically got boat raced by a team that stunk down the stretch.
Exactly, yeah. And that, you know, you had basically five teams, and again, varying levels, but all of them kind of, you know, have different levels of embarrassment, you know, in the way that they lost. That's going to hurt you, you know, just your perception as a conference. Again, it's hard to really, you know, sum up in a conference's entire season in a single elimination tournament, but when you have five teams losing the way that they did, it's going to hurt, and people again are looking to push that agenda. They have clear now evidence that they can do so.
Speaking of trying to push an agenda here, we have to talk about our friends from the ACC, who once again, I mean, aside from Virginia, all four teams that made the round of 64 all advanced to the Sweet 16. They're the most teams in the Sweet 16 of any conference here. We're getting this thread again. Oh, the ACC did well against the Big 12 in the regular season. Like, we should have gotten more teams in than we did. And like, guys, your league stunk for the most part here. Like, maybe you guys got a break and you didn't play a ton of tough teams and you guys are fresher for March than these other teams are. But again, like, as you said, small sample size not mean that the AC is better than it was this year.
Exactly. And we're in lockstep in this one. The ACC was a top heavy league all year long. We knew that Virginia was kind of fraudulent, but you know, North Carolina, we looked at as a national title all year long. You know, no one's surprised that North Carolina is through to the second weekend. Duke is another team that, you know, yeah, they had their ups and downs, but I don't think anyone is shocked that Duke is playing in the second weekend of the NCAA tournament. Clemson is a team that, you know, has been in the top 15 at some point this season. Like, it's clearly been there for Clemson. It just hasn't come out enough throughout the year. And then NC State is playing right now on this hot streak, you know, like a team that you know, is a top 15, top 25 team. And they obviously got a big break playing Oakland in the second round. So, yeah, I don't think that this is some kind of discourse on the ACC of all, you know, Pitt and Wake Forest and Virginia deserve their bid and everything like that. Like, no, this was a pretty top heavy conference that, you know, has two teams that were not surprised at all that are in the second weekend. One team that is playing outstanding basketball and maybe got a very favorable matchup in NC State in the second round. And then a Clemson team that it's been there, like I said, throughout the season, it just hasn't come out enough. So I don't think it's that shocking that this team sent four to the Sweet 16. And I don't think it, again, I don't think it's this grand statement about, oh, the ACC was underrated all year long. Like, no, they really weren't. If you look at the teams in that conference, I don't think they were at all.
Yeah, and the Clemson boy here, I mean, non-conference Clemson was very good. I mean, they had wins against Boise State. They won at Alabama. They beat South Carolina. They beat TCU. They beat UAB. They beat five tournament teams outside the league. I mean, like, they just had that dip in, like, January where they, like, forgot how to play basketball for a month, and then they sort of got back on track towards the end of the year.
Exactly, yeah. And I didn't see many people at all picking Clemson to make a run to the Sweet 16, so kudos to them. That's awesome. But it's clearly been there, and they clearly have a talented team has maybe their ceiling beat, you know, a Sweet 16, top 15 type team. So it's not shocking to see that Clemson made this run. But at the end of the day, this is not a statement of all, you know, because Clemson made this run, that means that, you know, Pitt was better than we thought, or Wake Forest was better than we thought. Like, I don't think that's the case.
Yeah. As the Big East guy, let's check the floor here. Big East here goes three bids, perfect 9-0 through the Sweet 16 here. We expected all three of them to be there for the most part here. Creighton gave you a scare against Oregon, but they hit the big shots they needed to. UConn curb-stomped Brooklyn to get to more home games in Boston here. Marquette got Kolick back. He looked pretty good in his first two games here. So what do you think here about what we saw from the Big East this week?
Yeah, absolutely. Impressive from the Big East. I can't sound like a hypocrite because of what I just said about the ACC and say that the same doesn't necessarily apply to the Big East. You know, when you look at the Big East, obviously it doesn't make this huge statement that, you know, the conference should have sent more teams in because the top three teams are rolling everyone. But, you know, at the end of the day, I am curious to see what the Big East does going forward now, because, you know, if this conference does send, you know, three teams to the Elite Eight and maybe even three teams to the Final Four, then it's going to get really, really interesting in terms of the discourse on, you know, how only three Big East teams got in. But again, I don't want to make some grand statement about the conference just based off of what the top teams in the conference are doing. But, you know, you could argue three of the more impressive teams of the weekend were the three Big East teams. You know, when you look at what Creighton did against Oregon, Marquette battling against Colorado, and then UConn just steamrolling everyone. I don't know how anyone beats UConn right now. Obviously, beating the 16 seed is one thing, but, you know, beating a Northwestern team that I thought Northwestern was going to give them a game. You know, I thought Northwestern was boo-booey, a senior-laden team that has some experience in the tournament. I thought that they were going to give them a game, and that game was over within the first 10 minutes. Just kind of shows you how talented UConn is. It's going to be interesting to see now who they have to go through. Obviously, San Diego State first, and then if they win that game, who they end up getting in their second game between Illinois and Iowa State. But at the end of the day, it's UConn's tournament to lose, and we saw it this weekend.
Yeah, so looking ahead to the Sweet 16 here, we'll go to the Thursday matchups first here with the West. I got the CBS for treatment here. First of all, can we point out here about how ridiculous it is that Arizona is playing at 7:09 and they're playing basically 5:00 Arizona time?
I know. Yeah, again, like the TV schedule, I don't fully understand it. Yeah, like why do you have – and then like North Carolina, Alabama is the later game. What is the thought process behind that? It makes no sense to me that you're starting the two East Coast teams in a game that, by the way, is going to start after 10 o'clock. Because that's assuming that they play a perfect two-hour game. That game's going to start well after 10 o'clock on the East Coast. And you have Arizona playing the 7:00 game. I guess it's like, you know, fit in already that those games have to start at those times. But could you not fix it to maybe have the two East Coast teams playing the earlier game? I don't know.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense, especially because, like as you said, 9:39 means 10:05 with the way the tournament runs.
Exactly. Yeah, these games never start at the time that they're supposed to start when they're the second game of a doubleheader. So we know that game's going to start at after 10:00 means it's not going to end till after midnight on the East Coast, means that anyone that is, you know, working, having to work the following day, they're not going to be able to watch that game, or at least the end of that game.
Yeah, let's also, I mean, take a look here. I mean, this West by your Clemson, Arizona, Alabama, North Carolina here. I think the games, I think, look nice on paper. I think you might be in for some blowouts, though, in these two games.
You could be, yeah. I mean, the entertainment value, I was actually looking at the North Carolina, Alabama. I think the over-under was like 172 or something. I mean, you're talking about entertainment value. That game has the potential to be an awesome up and down high scoring game. We'll see if Alabama can hang with them. And then Arizona Clemson, like I said, you know, Clemson's been a team that has, definitely overplayed what we thought they were going to be. I don't think anyone really thought they would be here. They're kind of one of only two teams that's kind of the surprises that's made it this far. But, you know, could be two blowouts, but I'm really looking forward to that UNC Alabama game, to be honest with you, because that is going to be an up-and-down, high-scoring game. You know, look at North Carolina's first two games. They score 90 and 85. Alabama has a low-scoring game yesterday against Grand Canyon. They score 72. And in the first round, they drop 109 on Charleston. And that Alabama-Grand Canyon game, it was a little bit sloppy, but maybe the most chaotic game of the first round with some of that. I think at some point the announcers even point out, they were like, this game is just pure chaos. Like, that game, that North Carolina-Alabama game, has the potential to be a high-scoring slugfest. It could be a blowout, of course, but at the end of the day, I'm looking forward to that game for sure.
Yeah, I think in terms of the Grand Canyon thing, I think it's funny. Charles Barkley said, I think during halftime, he's like, yeah, like, does Grand Canyon actually run a play the entire game?
Yeah, no one loved going like 1-on-4 more than Grand Canyon in that game. It was just like, I think at some point, I don't remember who was doing the games. One of the announcers was like, I don't think they see the defenders. Like, they're just going to the basket. They could care less how many defenders are there. They're going to the basket. Again, chaotic game. And that's what you love about Alabama. They're going to play these up and down, high scoring games. So even if it's a blowout, it'll be like an NBA blowout where there's a lot of, you know, shot making and things like that.
Yeah. I think what's scary at that game though, is that like, we saw North Carolina flip the switch in the middle of the game against Michigan State when they were down early. They played up a notch on the defensive end here. And Alabama will give up 96 points to Charleston. That doesn't go well for playing North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was a Michigan State team. I saw a stat that was one of the best in the country at not giving up, you know, these big runs to opponents. I don't remember the exact stat, but one of the best teams in the country at, you know, not allowing opponents to go on these big runs. And UNC does exactly that to Michigan, to completely turn that game on its head and take control. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, if Alabama's defense does not improve, which at this point, I don't know if it's going to. Yeah, North Carolina is a pretty safe bet to score 80 to 90 points in this game. It's just, can Alabama stay with them?
Yeah, let's go to the East region now here. We have San Diego State and UConn here in the first game on TBS, which gets the UConn fans angry here that they have not been on CBS, I think, since the first round. And then we have Illinois-Iowa State, the late game in Boston here. So what do you think about these two games here? I feel like, the first game, I feel like, is trending towards blowout territory because San Jose is trying to keep it a rock fight, and then it's not God will just out push them here. But the late game has intrigue.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this is UConn's region to lose, of course. It's not going to be easy. This game might be a little bit of a cakewalk, like you mentioned, because I just don't think San Diego State has the firepower to keep up with this UConn team. Like you said, they're going to try to turn it into a rock fight, and that's not going to work with UConn because UConn's going to hit their shots for sure. This game is played in Boston. I mean, it's going to be a 75% UConn crowd. I mean, you know, every GA ticket sold is going to be UConn. So that obviously works in their favor as well. But the later game, you know, Illinois and Iowa State, I am really looking forward to that game. Illinois, another team, 85 points in their first game, 89 in their second round game against an Iowa State team that plays obviously this phenomenal defense. Iowa State's looked really impressive through two games in the tournament. That's a clash of styles for sure. I'm actually looking forward to that because those two teams, I think, could really give UConn a game. I don't know if they're going to beat UConn, but either way, I think that we're getting a matchup in the Elite Eight that UConn can at least be challenged a little bit, because I'm like, I don't want to see UConn just completely roll everyone on the way to the Final Four. So the winner of that game, at the very least, will give UConn a game, I would think.
Yeah, for sure. Let's go now to the Friday slate here. We'll start with the it's like the Midwest, the South region got CBS. So it's NC State, Marquette, then Duke and Houston here, which is the late game here, the highlight game here, which is a little better because it's Friday night and people act like they're working the next day. But we've got these two games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, but still, like, you're putting, you know, your marquee game, which is Houston and Duke at 9:39. Again, going to start after 10 o'clock. It's a Friday night, sure, but that game's going to start after 10 o'clock. That's, you know, maybe the most intriguing game from a television perspective of the Sweet 16 starting after 10 o'clock. But, you know, I think Duke is kind of playing with house money at this point now. This team's ceiling probably, you know, if you would have asked any Duke fan, would have been a second weekend type team. So we'll see how far they can get now. Obviously, this is going to be their toughest challenge because at the end of the day, you know, Marquette's a very good team, but they're not Houston. And NC State, you know, Duke knows that they're not Houston. So a real opportunity for Duke. I saw the stat. Duke has not beaten a team that was seeded higher than them since 1991 in the NCAA tournament. Insane stat. Duke has not basically, you know, beaten a higher seed than them for over 30 years in the NCAA tournament. They have a chance to do that here against the Houston team that has shown some, you know, cracks, obviously, you know, needing overtime to get past Texas A&M. Duke's probably been the most impressive team of the first round. I saw people picking them to lose to Vermont in the first round, and they've rolled through them, and then obviously they've rolled through James Madison like nothing. So Duke's been incredibly impressive through two games. Big opportunity for them. And then, you know, you talk about opportunity, Marquette. You know, you're playing an 11 seed for a chance to go to the Elite Eight and be one win away from the Final Four. You know, this is the benefit of having Kentucky knocked out, is you get an NC State team, you get a couple of days to prepare for them. If you're Marquette, there's no excuse. Like, you can't lose this game. You know, this is the best team you'll have probably in a while. And this is the best opportunity you're going to have in a while to get to that Elite Eight and to get one step away from the Final Four. So I'm excited to see how they respond to that.
Yeah, I think in terms of what I like in this region here, obviously, like, NC State, I think you're hoping for Tyler Cole to tweak the oblique. I don't think they're going to keep up with them if they're going to go up and down the floor of Marquette. But the Duke game is intriguing here. We saw the Duke tease with their ceiling here against James Madison, where this is a team that basically waxed Wisconsin from the second they got on the floor, and they dominated that game from start here. And if they get more on Kyle Filipowski, the upset's definitely in play because Houston has some depth issues.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. You know, if you can get a lead on Houston and kind of, you know, control that game, it's going to be tough for them to come back. Cause like you mentioned, they don't have a deep bench right now at all. They're not playing deep. So if you can, you know, kind of take a lead on them and control the game, it's going to be tough for them to, you know, kind of force a comeback. So opportunity knocks. I think, you know, you talk about the opportunities, it's Marquette and it's Duke. Are they going to be able to deliver on the opportunity they've been given in the second weekend?
All right, last region here, the Midwest region. That's the TBS one. We got Gonzaga and Purdue in Detroit on 7:39 Friday night. Creighton, Tennessee is the late game, the most intact seeding, I think, of any region outside of the East. And I think these are two very fun games, especially Gonzaga saw Purdue and Maui this year. They played them close. They have an idea of what they need to do, try and slow Edie down. And Creighton, Tennessee, who the hell knows which version of each of these teams going to show up?
Yeah. This is the best region of the weekend for sure, in my opinion. You get, you know, two awesome games. Purdue obviously looks amazing through two games, just went absolutely through Utah State on Sunday. And Gonzaga, you know, I know Duke was incredibly impressive as well. Gonzaga as well, maybe one of the most impressive teams of the first round. You know, so many people picking McNeese to beat them. And that game was such a blowout. I hardly even watched it, you know, because, when you're in that first round window and you're kind of, you know, flipping around games, usually you don't see the beginning of games, you know, because you're watching the end of another game and you got the end of another game and then you turn this game on, you know, maybe towards halftime. By the time you did that with the Gonzaga McNeese game, it was over. Like, Gonzaga ran them off the floor. And then Kansas, what an impressive second half from Gonzaga. That game looked like it was going to be back and forth, a battle to the final buzzer. And Gonzaga just says, no way, we're going on this run to start the second half and we are going to blow you out of the gym. So Gonzaga playing outstanding basketball right now. And obviously Purdue is Purdue. Can't wait for that one. And like you mentioned, Creighton, Tennessee, what a matchup that is. Just two outstanding offensive teams, some great players, Dalton Connect, obviously. And then you got Creighton, you know, with Shireman and Kalkbrenner and Alexander, you know, what a matchup that's going to be. They've played some awesome games already in the second round. So really, really looking forward to that. And I just think this region is going to deliver with two awesome games and hopefully a third awesome game in the Elite Eight.
Yeah, intrigue here for me is two things. Number one, like can Rick Barnes get the monkey off his back, get back to the Final Four? I don't think he can, but we'll see. I think having one superstar scorer as opposed to three is a problem in that first game. And the other thing is here is, like, we haven't seen Purdue get pushed yet in this tournament. Where, like, we see on the Big Ten tournament, that, like, when they get in these games where they're tight down the stretch here, like, they tend to, you know, tighten up. They tend to get away from things that got them these leads. And Gonzaga might be a team that could, you know, give them a fight here down the stretch. You get to see if they have the mental guts to sort of get through all those games.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, you know, if they can get through, that obviously could end up being a great thing for them. You know, but yeah, like you said, if this game is a 5-point game or a 2-point game with 5 minutes to go, let's say, you know, do they start kind of thinking of those emotions of FDU, you know, or previous upsets that they've suffered years prior? And does that kind of get in their head? So we will see about that.
All right, here. So for last thing here, is your Final Four still intact on your bracket?
No, mine's blown up a long time ago. I had Kentucky going to the Final Four. I did a couple of different brackets. None of them are perfect, I don't think, in terms of having a Final Four. I had St. Mary's in one of my Final Four. I tried to take a shot. In most of them, I have three at least, but no, I don't have any perfect ones.
I have three as well. I lost Kentucky. I had everything else still intact. So,
Kentucky took a lot of people out.
Yeah. So let's go ahead. Your Final Four picks here. Like, what are you doing?
Oh, okay. So obviously, UConn's going through in the East. It's just I don't see anyone beating them, to be honest with you. In the South, I'll go with my Big East team. I'll go with Marquette. You know, I think that they can get through NC State, and then, you know, who knows but who they get in the Elite Eight. But I'll take Marquette. In the Midwest, I think it's Purdue's, to be honest. I really do. I think Gonzaga gives them a game, like we said, but I think that they get through. And I don't want to pick all one seeds, but I might have to. So I'm going to have to go with North Carolina. So I'll go with in the South. So I'll go with, or in the West, sorry. So I'll go with 3-1 seeds and Marquette, the 2 seeds. So I'll go a little bit chalky. I'll keep up the trend of the chalk so far in this tournament. And, you know, we've seen so far higher seeds have done fantastic. Favorites have done fantastic in this tournament so far. So I'll keep that up. I'll go with the 3-1 seeds and the 2 seed at Marquette.
We're in agreement on UConn. UConn's just going to curb stomp their way to the Final Four. Yeah. Two more home games in Boston here. The South have taken Duke. I like the momentum they're riding here. I think they're overdue to get a big win here. I don't trust Houston right now. I think A&M exposed some flaws in their game. I think they're going to lose that game. And Houston will beat Marquette. I mean, Duke will beat Marquette to get to the Final Four. The Midwest, I have Creighton prior to the tournament. I will stick with Creighton here. I think they got their white knuckle out of the way against Oregon and survived. I don't think Purdue is going to be up for the challenge of closing out one of these big games. I think that's going to end up biting them in the butt. And in the West, Caleb Love revenge game, Arizona.
Oh, okay. Okay. I was down on them going into the NCAA tournament, and they've looked really good through two games. They get a little bit of a break in playing Clemson. And like you said, North Carolina, Alabama, those are two teams that are vulnerable. North Carolina, probably the most vulnerable of the one seeds. And then Alabama, obviously, we've talked about their deficiencies as well. So, yeah, if you're looking to take a shot in that region, Arizona is definitely the team to pick.
Yeah, plus I think nobody in that game is more excited to win than Caleb Love.
Exactly, yeah. You know he's going to have a good game in that spot.
Yeah, for sure. Troy, thanks for all the time. We really appreciate it. We'll be back next week. We'll wrap up what we saw this weekend and get you ready for the Final Four.
Of course. Thanks, Mike.
If people want to follow me on social media, how can they do that?
I'm on Twitter at Troy Moriello, Maurielo. Okay, if you're a St. John's fan, check out my musings with the St. John's Red Storm team. It's basically all I tweet about. So if you're a St. John's fan, definitely check it out.
I will say, keep an eye on Troy's Twitter if Cal does leave Kentucky here. Things are getting spicy there.
Yeah, there'll be a lot of panic tweets if Cal ends up leaving and we get some rumors about Rick. So hopefully we don't have to deal with that, though.
All right, thanks for all the time. Really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks, Mike.
The 2-Minute Drill.
All right, 2-Minute Drill time here. We got a bit of a surprise last week from the Mets. They signed DH J.D. Martinez a 1-year deal worth $12 million. The deal pays Martinez $4.5 million this year with $1.5 a year deferred, starting in 2034, ending in 2038. Lowers the luxury tax hit for Steve Cohen, which is a big deal this year considering how much money he's paying the guys not on the roster. Getting a lot of a massive boost. Mets fans have been asking for years for proper protection behind Pete Alonso in the lineup. We've seen them try Mark Canna there. We saw Daniel Vogel back there most of last year. It has not worked. The fit with J.D. Martinez was perfect. Martinez is still an elite slugger. He made the all-star team with the Dodgers last year. He had a tremendous bad ball profile. It shows that he's still a guy. He's not about to fall off a cliff. The Mets got a look at Mark Vientos in spring training. Clearly did not like what they saw. Yes, Vientos hit some homers. Wasn't consistent enough to trustify trying to break both him and Brett Beatty in the same lineup for a team hoping to make a wild card run. Remember, this is not the regime that drafted Mark Vientos. This is the David Stearns regime, and David Stearns is not with Mark Vientos. Vientos not headed to AAA. He's going to play third base every day. He gives the Mets some insurance if Brett Bay is not impressed early on. The Mets could have kept Vientos up for a week while Martinez played in the minors to get his time back, but instead they're playing to either DJ Stewart or a late pickup if someone they think can fit shakes loose with split contract in the next few days. And, you know, it's probably the right call. Don't you jerk Vientos around here. You want Vientos to play. Send him to AAA. Let him work on his defense at third. Things he can improve in terms of his eye of the plate. Better than to get the regular bats than play twice and get sent back down. There are plenty of questions still on the Mets, including the rotation. What exactly are you getting from third base with Beatty? Right field, is Starling Marte healthy? And Harrison Bader stay healthy in center field? What can they give you at the bat? All that stuff. DH is no longer a question, though. If the Mets, top of the lineup, should help them win a lot of games this year, which is good. If this team can compete for the playoffs. I want to end the show for the week. I want to thank Troy Moriello for hopping on here once again to do our March Madness coverage. Always fun chatting college hoops with Troy. Work on stuff like this podcast, including my full NCAA tournament bracket. I published it Tuesday prior to the start of the tournament for full transparency. Check out the blog over at justonthesuffering.wordpress.com. Check out the Sky Guys podcast. We have a recap of episode 8 of the Bad Bass Season 3 out now on the feed. The recap for episode 9, it might be a big one, dropping Thursday night, so keep an eye on the Sky Guys. He like all that Star Wars stuff. You can follow me on social media, mphillips331. M-P-H-I-L-I-P-S 331. We'll be back in a few days here with our baseball coverage here, the opening day, the over-unders, and more. But until then, I hope you have a better week than Kentucky fans.